Welcome to the Yanks Are Coming podcast. My name is Carter Krishner. This week we have Dennis Crowley, the founder of the Kingston Stockade Football Club and co-founder of Foursquare, the big technology company that I'm sure everyone's heard of. He sat down with me late last week to talk about the U.S. Soccer Pyramid, his club, NPSL, and a variety of other subjects related to the game in this country.
Well, Dennis Crowley, you're a famous name in both the tech world and now in the soccer world in the United States. What first got you into the sport? Because you're a recent convert to soccer, and you're a Gen Xer like me, but just got into it in the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, kind of recent in the last 10 years. I didn't grow up playing. I didn't play in high school. I didn't play in college. But, you know, like my group of friends in New York, a lot of them, you know, played in high school and college and some outside of college. Like some of them were working or some of them are working in soccer or working for sports magazines or blogs. And so, you know, I kind of got into it just by following the World Cup and following, you know, the adventures of the men's national team. And, you know, I kind of, long story short, you know, after without having a team in New York to cheer for the longest time, you know, we really thought, hey, we should just try to make a team. We'll try to do it from scratch. So that's where Kingston Stockade came from.
Why did you pick Kingston? That's your hometown?
Well, I live in Manhattan, and my wife and I, we got married like 4 years ago. We got married up in the Hudson Valley, which is, you know, an area about 2 hours north of the city. And we loved it so much up there that we ended up buying a house up there. And so, you know, we have an apartment in the city, but we go up to this house as much as we can, you know, every weekend usually. I'm on my way up there right now. I'm in the car. You know, it was really, we were sitting on the porch one day 2 summers ago, and, you know, like, I really wish I could just go to a match. It'll be fun to go to a match in the afternoon. And the idea just kind of hit us, like, hey, if we're going to make a team, we should make a team here. We put it in Kingston. And after that, you know, you start thinking, like, about the logistics. And, you know, we found, there's a stadium downtown that I only thought of as, like, a track around the field that people, you know, work out on the track. And I was like, we could play here. I mean, there's seats for 1,000 people here. Then you start, you know, making some phone calls and putting things together. And before you know it, we were planning for our 2016 season.
Dennis, tell us how the community embraced this team, because I think this is one of the really cool things about putting a semi-pro team in a smallish town. Yeah, Kingston is close to Poughkeepsie, it's close to Newburgh, which are decent-sized places, but it is a small town itself. Talk about the community embracing it.
Yeah, a population of about 20,000 people, and it's not the biggest town up in the area, but, you know, to be honest, I think it's one of the most interesting towns. You know, like Kingston used to be the capital of New York if you go back to, like, the 1800s. You know, it's a Dutch settlement. It was burned to the ground by the British, I think, twice. Like, it's just got this really rich history. And the town has been, you know, it's gone through multiple stages of, like, almost getting, like, almost turning into something big, and it just kind of, it just hasn't happened yet. But what's happened is there's been all these, like, all this awesome creative energy. You know, entrepreneurs and artists and, you know, musicians and people that are opening, like, breweries and bake shops and just doing all sorts of interesting stuff in the, you know, in the physical world. And a lot of times they're doing it in Kingston because the real estate is relatively cheap and the cost of living is a little bit cheaper than you find in some of the surrounding areas. So there's really great energy up there. And so when we brought the, you know, we started the team, you know, I wish I had some, like, real data here, but I think a lot of the fans that we have, and we were getting close to 1,000 fans per game, a lot of them had never even been to an MLS game before. They've never seen a professional or high-level soccer game before. But it's just like, hey, this thing's in the town, and the way the town is, everyone's kind of, you know, helping out everyone else. And so, you know, the community just embraced it. And, you know, we did as much as we could to kind of fuel back into it. Like, my thinking with a lot of this stuff was, it was never like, okay, we're going to put on a soccer game, you're going to come and see the soccer game, and it lasts, you know, 90 minutes, and you're going to stay here for 2 hours. It was more, listen, we're going to do something that's going to bring 1,000 people together on a Saturday, and it's going to be the best 2 hours of the whole week. And so what else do you guys want to do while we're here? You know, move on to sing national anthem. Like, who wants to, you know, be the supporters group? Who wants to do this? Who wants to do that? What do you want to bring food trucks in? Should we push people to the uptown area? Like, we kind of made it a platform for people to build on top of. And I think that's what's really interesting to a lot of the folks in the community.
Yeah, you mentioned the kind of environment in the community with a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of craft breweries, et cetera. You obviously, I think all our listeners know, are the co-founder of Foursquare. Talk about how that entrepreneurial spirit kind of spurred you on to do this.
You know, let me say two things, right? So, you know, something that people, you know, I get a lot of people are like, you know, doing a soccer team is so different than doing a tech company, right? And the answer is not really. You know, like, if you look at what made Foursquare what it is, and we've been doing Foursquare for like 8 years, but, like, there's a huge community element of Foursquare. I mean, there's 50 million people around the world that use this thing, and there's tens of thousands of people that are, like, editors of the community, right? And so, like, we've always just been kind of, I don't feel like we've been good at it, but, like, we've always put community first. It's like, you can't just build something and then have it work. Like, people need to chip in, and that, you know, that worked well with Foursquare, and it's worked great with Farcade so far. You know, but to your second question about, like, the entrepreneurial energy, there's something weird about, like, you know, when we started Foursquare, people kept saying, like, this is a dumb idea, it's never gonna work, like, why are you doing this, why are you wasting your time on this? And, yeah, you run into these, like, you know, these hurdles all the time where people don't understand what you're doing, and they don't understand why it's interesting or different, or you know, they don't understand, it's so different that they don't understand why it's interesting or important. And, you know, it's the same thing with Stockade, right? So, you know, Foursquare is my second startup. I had one before this too. And, you know, Stockade is probably my third startup, if you think about it, right? And, you know, it was the same thing. People like, what are you working on? You're working on this, like, small minor league team? Like, why is that even important? Why is that even interesting? And, you know, you just keep doing it long enough before you start to figure out your own answers to those questions. But I think, you know, like, the big thing with just entrepreneurial endeavors in general is just, you know, when people push back and tell you that whatever you're working on is kind of a stupid idea or a lousy idea because they don't understand it, like, that's the fuel that should keep you going so you just continue to, you know, push forward and make this thing that you want to see.
You're on your way right now to a Stockade game. You're leaving Manhattan, and you work during the week in Manhattan, and you go back to Kingston. Excuse me, I almost called the town Stockade. Kingston for the weekends and for the games as well. Tell us a little bit about why you chose NPSL as a league and why you didn't maybe make the leap into the professional ranks. And this is something just as a point of reference for me as someone who worked for the NASL, for the league, for 3.5 years, and I've worked for various teams as well, but for the league for 3.5 years, I found that the real kind of energy and community-based teams were ending up in PDL and NPSL, and I think there was also a cost factor that had to do with that, and also just maybe a kind of hipness, coolness factor for community-based teams to be supporter-driven at that level. So tell us a little bit about your decision to go to NPSL.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, the original, you know, story behind the club was, I hinted at this a little bit, but, like, we had my buddies and I, we played pickup in the city, right? We pick up in the city, and, you know, we had this idea, like, everyone's getting older, and everyone's moving to Westchester and having kids and can't play anymore. And we had this idea of, like, what would have to happen for our club to play the Red Bulls? And that was a conversation that we had over beers one night. I was like, we know it can happen through the U.S. Open Cup, but how the heck do we even get in the Open Cup? Can you qualify? How does this whole process even work? And I remember losing, this was like 2 years ago, I lost myself in Wikipedia for like 2 days, kind of learning about all the mechanics of the different leagues and the qualification processes. And, you know, you learn about, okay, NASL, it's going to cost, holy cow, it's going to cost millions of dollars to put a club here. USL, holy cow, it's going to cost $1 million to get a club here. And you start to see PDL with the buying of, like, I think it was like 75 grand at the time. Then, you know, we start uncovering all the stories of the NPSL teams where, you know, the operating costs are lower, the buy-in costs are lower. And then you're looking at, like, you know, we're looking at Chattanooga and Detroit as some of the examples of other teams, and it's like, well, this is what we want to be. Like, we want to be these teams when we grow up. You know, like, we're self-aware as a group, and we know that we're not going to, you know, we're not trying to be the Cosmos here yet. You know, we're not trying to make a run in the USL, you know, yet, whatever, in the higher divisions. It's more like, let's just see if we can start a team from scratch, and let's see how much it costs, and let's see if we could pull it off, and let's see if it could be successful. And so we chose the NPSL because, you know, the operating costs were the lowest. And that's where the most interesting stories were. You know, if it's like Detroit and Chattanooga are the teams we look up to, it's like, that's the best party going on in lower-level soccer. Let's go to that party. That's where we want to be.
Yeah, I agree there. I think a couple of us, including Steve Bernasconi, who were taping this a week after he's blown through town and gone to a Stockade game with you, he and I would sit in the Fort Lauderdale Strikers office 2 years ago saying, you know, the cool stories, the cool things going on in this sport in this country all seem to be happening at the NPSL level. And obviously Detroit and Chattanooga came to mind right away, but some other teams, and of course you started up the following year, and Minneapolis City FC now is another one. Soccer in Europe, football in Europe, is based around communities, right? And it's based around community institutions and the buy-in from the community, similar to what you've done in Kingston. Walk us a little bit through that, because I think that's a little bit different than the way franchises pop up in MLS or NASL or USL. And you have what I would consider to be, even though it's an organic local model, also kind of a European model on how things have evolved for you guys.
Yeah, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about something kind of interesting, right? And I think this is related to your question. But, you know, I think when you get to the level where the teams are really expensive and operating a club is a full-time job, like, the people that work in those industries, they are soccer people. You know, and that's how it should work. Like, they're professional soccer people. You need professional soccer front office. And the thing that you get in the lower-level leagues is you get people that do it on the side as a hobby. So you get, you know, your random tech entrepreneur, your random, you know, design folks. You get your random person that runs, like, a marketing shop somewhere. These are people that, like, you know, they want to run their own teams. They're not necessarily, like, quote-unquote soccer people in terms of, you know, they're not professional coaches. They're not professional team operators. They're just people that have, like, really interesting skill sets that are looking at building or creating a club in a community from a different perspective. And I think it's that makes the, you know, it's like these creative types that are pretending to be soccer people, I think that's the stuff that makes these teams so interesting, as opposed to, you know, professional soccer people that are working really hard to understand the creative and the community part.
Right along the lines of what I was thinking, you run the front office of Kingston and a lot of the merchandise out of your car, out of your trunk.
Yeah.
The front office is on its way from Manhattan to Kingston as we speak. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think that is part of the startup soccer and support local soccer model.
Yeah, well, you know, like, I'm really interested in, you know, I'm interested in the pyramid in general. I'm interested in the whole, like, landscape of soccer in the U.S. Not just, like, as a fan, right? Like, when I was trying to figure out how to get our club team into the U.S. Open Cup, you know, step one being get 11 guys that know how to play, not because we're all awful, right? But when we were thinking about that, that's when I really started learning about kind of like all of the lower levels of this stuff. And it's really, you know, I found all of that just so fascinating. Yeah, it's just like, I'm interested in the pyramid, so I'm interested in how all the pieces come together. Like, this is like, you know, I think the thing, and I'm still trying to wrap my own head around this, but the thing that I'm really passionate about is this idea of, you know, can we run the club like a successful local business, right? Like, everyone, you know, lower level soccer or any type of team ownership has the stigma of, like, oh, it's a hobby and you're wasting your money, you're lighting your money on fire. And I kind of want to get to the point where it's like, no. This is like running a restaurant, running a small business in your town, running a cupcake shop, whatever. Like, it's got to be a profitable entity, right? It's got to be something that's self-sustaining. And so I want to put together this blueprint for how do you do that with soccer at a lower level in the hopes of encouraging people to do this. Like, you can make this your job. Like, this could be your job if you wanted to do it. But, you know, when I was Googling around, how do you start a club? How do you get the club to, you know, to break even? There was nothing on the internet. Like, no one had written any articles or books or anything. And so when we started, the thinking was like, well, why don't we write it? We'll just write it as we go. And we'll write one big blog post at the beginning of every season. We'll write one big blog post at the end of every season until there's so much stuff on the internet that, like, anyone can figure out how to do this. And so, you know, that's the stuff that's interesting to me. You know, it's like, I mentioned before that, like, the Stockade Club, like, as an individual club, is kind of a platform for the community. Well, I want all the writing that we're doing and all the sharing of all the financials and all the data, I want that to be, like, a platform that people use to make their own clubs on top of it. And then, you know, you got to squint and kind of imagine 5 years from now, but, like, what if instead of, you know, 10 Chattanoogas and 10 Detroits, or 10 Stockades, you know, these teams that have kind of this, like, hip kind of, you know, following or whatever, building an audience and a brand. What if there's 100 of those, or 500 of them, or 1,000 of them? Then you've got, like, a lot of Lego blocks that you can start putting together to think about building, like, an alternative type of pyramid. And I think, you know, that's where we are right now. It's like, how do we build the resources that the entire pyramid needs to reassemble itself into something, you know, stronger and more sustainable, and potentially something that's even, you know, more interesting to the fan, because it's so local, because it's so rich, because it's like you can build amazing narratives around it.
Right, and we see this with the television ratings for MLS, and really the lack of interest nationally in USL and NASL, that if you don't have a team in your local community that you're going and supporting, you don't care. And in fact, what we found with the television ratings with MLS, which of course I cover over at World Soccer Talk, is that fans of teams like Portland and Orlando and now Atlanta don't necessarily follow the rest of the league. So I know a lot of Orlando fans that watch the Orlando games, and then the rest of the time they're watching the Premier League, right? Or they're watching Barcelona. They're not watching American soccer. So that you have to build some sort of context and relevance, which is also why I like the idea of regional rivalries, what NPSL is doing, what the rivalries that have sprung up in Detroit's neck of the woods with Grand Rapids and Ann Arbor, et cetera, Pontiac now. Walk us through kind of how you can make lower division soccer sustainable. Do you think it has to do with critical mass, having 100 Kingston/Chattanoogas instead of just 10 around the country? Is that the first step? Is that the key step?
Yeah, I think it's about making more clubs that people really care deeply about. I mean, the thing, like, when we looked at Detroit and Chattanooga and were inspired by them, I wasn't inspired by, like, oh, these guys have a working business, that's great. I was inspired by the fact that they made something from scratch that the community deeply cared about. And that's what we wanted to do in Kingston. And I think that's what other people should aspire to do. You know, like, I want to, you know, the only thing that bothers me about the NPSL is, like, it's a short season. But at the same time, I don't know how to get a longer season because we use mostly college players.
Right, that's another catch-22.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm thinking about, like, all right, well, we should have a women's team too, right? We should have a women's team, we should have a youth academy. I'm thinking of all the other things that we build on top of it. But I think it's, like, the primary goal is to, you know, turn your local community into something that's very soccer-first. And in doing so, you know, like, create something that people care about very deeply. They'll come out to the matches. You know, they'll go to the away games. They'll watch the streams. And so, you know, like, I haven't done the math here, and so this is going to sound really dumb until I do the math. But, you know, there's this argument where it's like people won't take some of this stuff seriously unless there's some really big numbers behind it. And so, you know, I'm a big believer of this idea of, like, you know, set a vision for 10 years out and then figure out how do you make that vision a reality, right? So just to kind of, like, spitball this for a second, you know, how many viewers does an MLS Mavs get on average? Do you know what the numbers are?
About 250,000. I should point out that's 250 for the games that are on ESPN and Fox, not for the local broadcast, which I'm sure are virtually nothing.
Yeah. So what kind of eyeballs, what numbers would you need in order for the NPSL or any other lower-level league to really be interesting or competitive? Let's say it's like a third of that or a half of that?
Yeah, I would say probably like 80,000 or so, 75,000, 80,000.
Okay,
viewers.
Now how many lower-level teams do you need in order to make that happen? You don't need 22 teams with a huge audience. You call it, you know, 500 or 600 teams with like a smallest audience.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? And then you're selling the same sponsorship package as you would to say like the MLS, but you're selling it across, you know, the streaming rights for 500 teams. And then instead of thinking of it as like, listen, this league needs to be on ESPN, you know, you look at it as like, what's going on with esports right now? Like, esports isn't on. Like, they didn't start trying to get on broadcast TV. They stream all the games online. You stream the whole tournament, the whole season online. And so you think of it as like building a league from scratch, but not from a broadcast TV perspective, but from like a streaming video perspective and what the revenue and sponsorship opportunities are around YouTube and Twitter video and Facebook video. And I think that's the way you got to think about it.
This is exactly right. And I think there is a challenge among old-time broadcast people, kind of the dinosaurs of the broadcast industry, on how to handle this. Because, for example, USL had all their games on YouTube two seasons ago. Now they're gradually, as they're trying to make a commitment to, quote, broadcasting and creating this kind of maybe artificial interest on TV in their league, which is, of course, a lower division league, just like the NPSL is, they begin to gravitate games onto television. And we're seeing fans and potential viewers complaining, saying, hey, you had acted 2 years ago like you understood digital, like you understood the millennials, you understood access and accessibility, and now all of a sudden you're just doing what MLS does. So that's the balancing act.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, we haven't even started our second season yet, but already Stockade seems less crazy to people than it did last year, right? Which is a sign that things are going well, right? But we were spitballing it last year. We were thinking, like, you know, imagine you started a sports league from scratch. What would you do differently? And it's a very convenient coincidence that esports, you know, I'm talking like people playing League of Legends and Street Fighter and all that stuff online. I mean, they are starting leagues from scratch, and they're seeing great success in this alternative broadcast model. And I think what the lower-level leagues need to do is model themselves more after that than trying to be, you know, replicate what MLS is doing. And it's just like, if you try to play the same game that they're playing, you're never going to win. But if you play a totally different game, that's how you end up being disruptive. And
right.
I think that's part of the model.
I had a conversation with someone the other day about the new supporter-driven club that's being created from former Fort Lauderdale Strikers fans in South Florida, and that was kind of the model for broadcasting, is to go that route, to emulate what people who are playing games online are doing, not what any league or, quite frankly, NPSL teams have done in the past, to kind of go in this different direction. One last thing I wanted to address with you about your manifesto and about all of the things you've laid on the table and the successes you've had with Kingston in a short period of time. You've taken on this kind of persona of someone who has a real interest in seeing things operate in a more efficient and more, what's the word I'm looking for, more successful fashion in this country, I guess, for lack of a better term. Talk about if we're able to do eventually, 10 years down the road, build an infrastructure on the outside that's different than what we have currently, how that impacts player development and interest in this sport and gets
We always hear the cliche, oh, the best athletes in this country don't play soccer. That's why we'll never be competitive. That's the fallback position from a lot of people who like to apologize for the current system and the mess that it's making. Talk about how this would impact player development, because I think you see it very much from that perspective as well.
Yeah, I think there's two things here. I mean, the first of which is, I wrote this in the manifesto that, like, without there's no incentive for us to invest heavily in the club. Like, you know, like, I don't want to say, like, we're taking a lazy approach. See, it's prestigious, right? But there's no prize money that would change the team. You know, there's no promotion that would change the team, right? So, like, why would I go from an amateur model to a pro model, right? Why would I even build a youth academy, except for the fact that it's, like, a fun project?
Right.
You know?
Because you're incurring costs, and you're not getting – you don't have anything that mitigates those costs if you jump to USL or NASL, right? I mean, that's essentially the reality of – why so many people like yourself and so many clubs stay in NPSL or stay in PDL, correct?
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, even if I invested heavily, I can't go anywhere. And then even if I could go somewhere, like D3 or D2, then I can't go anywhere from there.
Yeah, you can't go to D1 is the point, right? That's really the bottom line. And
yeah, it's not like we have any business going there, but, you know, it's unfathomable right now. But let's say, you know, we had investors that just wanted to pump money into the club so we could get there. Like, you just don't have that. You know, it's like, it just seems so broken to me, where my experience in doing tech stuff, right, and Foursquare has been financed by, you know, incredibly brilliant, you know, investors in the technology space. We've done multiple rounds of financing. But they keep putting gas in the tank because they want to see us win. And, you know, there is an end game. What's the end game for us? Like, you know, we are a thorn in the side of, like, Google, Apple, Facebook, like, other big internet companies. And there's, you know, that's a real opportunity for us, you know, Foursquare, the company. But those same type of opportunities, they just don't exist for us in, you know, in the soccer pyramid. Like, no matter how much money we put into the club, we will never be the thorn in the side of an NASL team or an MLS team, unless we write a check so that we can play alongside them. And that is what seems really broken.
Well, I mean, it's not that way anywhere else in the world, as we know.
Yeah. And like, listen, I totally understand the reason that exists. And I don't think that anyone's going to swoop in with their magic wand and fix it. I really think it's like, listen, you let the teams that want to operate like that continue to operate like that, and then you just make another system on the side. And you make that system on the side, and hopefully if it's bigger and better and more interesting than the system that already exists, then you start pulling viewers away. I mean, this is how, you know, it's like you look at the history. Forgive me for always using tech analogies, right? But there was 100 search engines that existed, and then Yahoo was the winner, and then Google did a better job than Yahoo, and so Google wins. And it's not like they paid someone the ability to compete against them. They just started something and built, and they were clever, and they made a better product. And I think that's what, like, you know, we talk about getting 300 or 500 teams together to do something interesting. Like, that's what it is. You're just making an alternative product, and you're making a bet that it'll be more interesting than the product that exists right now, because it's more local, because there's stronger narratives in it, because there's, you know, a mix of the, you know, do our own pro rel system that's not even connected to the existing D1. And it will work, I don't know, right? But is it worth trying? Like, certainly it's worth trying. And I think that's where our head is right now. And now it's just like, right, well, how do you go from that doesn't exist to that exists? And that's, you know, that's the problem to solve.
Yeah, I find it so interesting because defenders of the status quo often point to the kind of youngness, the youth of the professional game in this country, or the structure that they put in place. Obviously, the professional game predates the foundation of MLS, but really kind of this the structure that's put in place the last 20 years. And because it's so young, and because it has all these issues, it very much kind of fits that Yahoo analogy. For 5 or 6 years after the internet blew up, Yahoo was the search engine of record, right? And there were other competing search engines, but Yahoo was the search engine. They got into news. They got into all kinds of different portions.
Like
of
the, a better analogy is almost, you know, Friendster, MySpace, Facebook. Facebook wins. It's a better product. People like it more. You know, all the eyeballs are on Facebook now. And so, you know, if MLS right now is Friendster, right?
Right.
How do we come along and at least be the MySpace before another organized version comes along and becomes the Facebook?
Right. And I talk to people now who think that it might be happening with Snapchat and Instagram supplanting Facebook and Twitter. Now, who knows if that happens? But there are these conversations. Everything's very fluid, so we don't have to assume that the U.S. soccer pyramid or the U.S. soccer structure is static and will and needs to be static for us to be competitive. So,
Here's my last tech analogy, and I promise no more. But, you know, the gripe I have with, like, the current approach to, like, say, like, pro-rel and all the lobbying behind it. It's like people being like, we demand this, we demand this. Which is like trying to demand something out of Google or Facebook, and they're like, we don't care, we're doing our own thing here. You know, the only way to get it is that, you know, if you want something really bad, you don't ask Snapchat over and over again for it. You just go build it on the side. And if it becomes big enough, that Snapchat will either buy it or copy it, or your thing becomes, you know, as big as Snapchat, right?
Right.
And so, you know, it's just that. I just believe in that approach to creating an alternative structure. You know, like, you don't beg someone else to make it. You just get to work and start making it.
So you roll up your sleeves and do it, which is a big part of my critique of some folks in the pro-rel movement. But, Dennis, thank you for this, and we're going to keep an eye on Kingston Stockade this season.
Yeah, this is fun. I almost wish we could do it for another hour because I'm probably be in traffic at least that long.